This episode of Gunblog Varietycast brought to you by LawOfSelfDefense.com. Go to LawOfSelfDefense.com/variety to learn about your state's self-defense laws. Sign up for one of their online or in-person seminars or buy the book Law of Self-Defense and get 10% off when you use the discount code VARIETY at checkout. That's LawOfSelfDefense.com/variety. Sit back, relax, and take a ride with us on the Gunblog Variety Cast, episode 74. Welcome back to the Gunblog Variety Cast. I'm your host, Sean from NC Gunblog, and with me today is Adam from Guns, Cars, Tech Blog. How are you doing, Adam?
I feel much better now.
Oh, that's good. Well, let's get started with the Tactical Dog and Fitness Report. 21.5 dog walking miles, 3 spin classes, 1 day swimming, and I'm getting sick. But it's a 3-day weekend and I'm going to get a lot of sleep and try to get well.
Well, it appears that after 10 or so days of treatment, I am almost done with this hacking up a lung thing.
Yep, and I'm just starting and I blame you. You gave it to me.
Yeah.
It's internet AIDS.
Yes.
You gave it to me over Skype.
Clearly.
No, it's my annual upper chest congestion, and it's just starting, so I nailed it with all of the stuff that I'm supposed to nail it with, and staying very well hydrated, which I was hydrated well anyway, and I'm going to get as much sleep as I can, and I'm going to baby myself across the 3-day weekend, and just try not to be as much of a pain as I normally am when I'm sick to my wife, so.
Yeah, that's like me. When I'm sick, my wife is like, she has another kid.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, she only has one when I'm sick, and I'm going to try not to be that guy. So we'll see how that goes.
Good luck.
And now it's time for Blue Collar Prepping with that bratty kid sister of the gun blogosphere, Aaron Paulette. This week, Aaron's going to talk about barter and why it's a good skill to know.
Come on, every pony. It's time for Blue Collar Prepping with Aaron Paulette.
So, Aaron, what exactly is bartering?
Bartering is the exchange of services or goods for a service or good of equal value. For example, let's say that I need my car fixed, but I don't have the money for it. What I do have, however, is plenty of .22 long rifle ammunition. I might be able to find a mechanic who is willing to trade fixing my car for a brick or two of .22, and that's barter. Barter works best between individuals, as most businesses these days are cash only. However, there are a few exceptions, such as in Alaska, many shops accept payment in gold because of all the prospectors up there. Armed with a scale and the latest exchange rate, a gold panner can trade what he's found for food, guns, camping supplies, etc.
But Aaron, gold's just another form of money, isn't it? There are even rates for converting it into dollars.
This is true, but when you think about it, pretty much everything can be converted into dollars. If a loaf of bread costs $2 at the supermarket, then you know that the supermarket thinks bread can be converted into money at a rate of $2 per loaf. Really, money is just a fast and easy way to facilitate barter. Let's say that I have 2 dozen eggs, and you have loaves of bread for sale. Sure, I could trade you eggs for bread, but only if you want eggs in the first place. Maybe you don't, because you have chickens of your own. Money makes this easier because I can convert my eggs into cash by selling them, and then I take that cash to you and buy your bread. This is handy because we both agree that money is valuable. The problem, though, is that money is only valuable because everyone uses it, and everyone uses it because it's backed by the government. It isn't inherently useful. A $1 bill has the same intrinsic value as a $20 bill. So unless everyone agrees that a $20 bill is actually worth $20, it's about as valuable as a single sheet of toilet paper. So the ability to engage in productive barter is a useful skill to have when money no longer holds any value for people. The classic example is the Weimar Republic, post-World War I Germany, where inflation grew so high that people were bringing wheelbarrows of cash to the market in order to buy food. But a much more recent example of hyperinflation is Zimbabwe. Prior to 2007, the Zimbabwe dollar was worth about 1.5 American dollars. But between 2007 and 2009, runaway hyperinflation caused prices to skyrocket. At one point, a loaf of bread cost 50 million Zimbabwean dollars. At one point, the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe was printing out $100 billion notes. That's how bad it was. So as you can imagine, this caused drastic fluctuations in the dollar prices of food and other necessities. And so in cases like this, where money simply loses its meaning, the best way to purchase goods and services is through trading goods and services of equal value.
All right, let's say I need to barter with somebody. What do I need to know?
Chaplain Tim wrote an excellent article about the general principles of barter and trade over at Blue Collar Prepping Blog, and I've linked to it in the show notes below. But for this segment, what you need to know are the differences between price, value, and worth. Price is simply what the buyer and seller agree to exchange. Right now, goods and services are priced in dollars, but after a financial crash, other objects like a box of 22 or a gallon of gasoline may become the standard for trade. Value is highly subjective, based upon location and situation. A cigarette lighter may have no real value to me now, after all, I don't smoke, but if I'm lost in the woods in the middle of a snowstorm, the ability to start a fire becomes incredibly valuable. The price of the lighter hasn't changed, only its value. Worth is somewhere in the middle of price and value. Worth, put simply, is whatever someone else is willing to give me for an item. For example, a blanket I crafted by hand in order to sell has little value to me because I have several of them and don't need them all for survival. But because I have spent time, effort, and resources to make them, they have worth to me. When I sell that blanket, I need to make sure that I get at least its worth in goods or services in order to recoup my investment of time, effort, and materials put into making it. However, a buyer may not agree with what I think my blanket is worth, and if that's the case, they won't buy it, and then I am out of the time and effort I spent to make it. So, the buyer sets the worth of an object. Right now, worth and price are typically the same thing, but this isn't always the case. Time and location alter these. For example, sheets of plywood generally have low prices. But let's say a hurricane is getting closer, and people start buying more plywood to put over their windows. Because the value of the plywood goes up in the eyes of the public, these buyers decide that it is worth more, and therefore its price increases, sometimes criminally so. So the key idea with free exchange is that when two people barter, they each feel that they are trading up. They each trade away items that they feel have lower value to them for items that have higher value to them. If I have 3 dozen eggs with more on the way, I am happy to trade my extra eggs for your extra bread. I don't value my 14th egg nearly as much as I value my second one. You don't value your third loaf of bread nearly as much as you value your first. So when we trade, we're both happy, and that's a successful barter. Of course, there's more to bartering than simply knowing the difference between price, worth, and value. Supply versus demand is also a factor, and having people skills such as psychology, manipulation, or diplomacy will also affect the worth of an object.
All right, Aaron. This is valuable information, even if I got it for the low price of free. It was good to talk with you. See you again next week.
See you next week, Sean.
If you'd like to read more from Aaron, check out her blog, lurkingrhythmically.blogspot.com.
Felons behaving badly. Man in custody after standoff with police in Mint Hill. Dateline, Mint Hill, North Carolina. A man is in police custody after a standoff in Mint Hill early Saturday morning. According to Mint Hill Police, suspect 41 barricaded himself in an apartment in the 4500 block of Stony Terrace Drive just before 3 a.m. Officers were dispatched to the home after a 911 call from a female victim to Mint Hill authorities. When officers first arrived on scene, suspect allegedly shot at the first officer to approach the apartment building. When reinforcement authorities arrived, they also took fire from the suspect, police say. One officer returned fire but did not strike suspect. It was 3 or 4 gunshots, then it continued. 5 gunshots, then another gunshot, recalled Malik Howell, who shares an apartment below suspect with his father. I heard about 45 to 50 rounds. That gunshot seemed like it was never going to stop, said Howell's father, Michael Alsbrook. Police say that suspect was firing rounds at officers periodically, but no one was injured during the exchange. CMPD's SWAT team was activated after Mint Hill Police requested assistance with the situation. A negotiator with the unit was able to convince suspect to surrender himself without injury, and he was taken into police custody. Police evacuated residents of suspect's apartment building and some nearby buildings to CATS buses waiting close to the homes. Alsbrook said an officer knocked on his door and asked him to leave. "You have to leave. Get your clothes on. Let's go. They told me get everybody out with me," Alsbrook explained. Detectives are currently interviewing suspect and the other person inside the residence with him. The FBI has been called to help with the investigation. So, female in the residence called 911. Another story I heard, it was a hang-up call, so she called and then hung up. So they dispatched the police to it. First cop on the scene, he starts shooting at him. Next cop on the scene shoots at that cop. That cop shoots back, fires 45, 50 rounds. 3 o'clock in the morning, concealed handgun permit holder, right?
Yeah. You know, just one of those guys, you know, sits around. All he does is, you know, talk about guns all the time.
Probably runs a podcast.
Yeah, probably runs a podcast. And he's just waiting for that, you know, for that moment, for his moment.
Right.
And there it is.
Right. Probably goes to training.
All the time. That's why he missed. He missed on purpose.
Big boy rules.
Yeah.
DWI level 3, misdemeanor non-class code. Disorderly conduct, misdemeanor class 2. Driver's license revoked, misdemeanor class 1. Manufacturer schedule 2, felon class H. 2 counts, possess controlled substance, felon class H. 2 counts, possess with intent to sell, schedule 2, felon class H. 2 counts, assault with a deadly weapon, inflicting serious injury, felon class E.
One of these days, I'm going to get it right. One of these days.
One of these days, it's going to be somebody who's like, oh, wow, you know, just a totally normal person, not doing anything wrong. And he snapped, but not today. It looks like Nikki is taking requests. So Aaron wanted Nikki to talk about the open-air rape attacks in Cologne, Germany, and what that means for the future of Europe and foreign refugees. So Nikki, I hear you're taking requests now for the foreign policy portion of this podcast. Is that your radio background coming into play?
Well, perhaps a little. This was a good topic to talk about in any case, but Aaron approached me with a request to talk about it, so I'm here to help. So let's talk about what's going on in Europe and the refugee situation there.
The situation is not working out quite the way the Europeans had planned it, is it? The Paris attacks in November were an eye-opener when we learned that one of the guys had a refugee passport, right?
He did. He came in with a wave of Syrian refugees and joined his comrades in launching attacks on Paris. Recently, another so-called Syrian citizen, who turned out to be an Islamic State suicide bomber, just launched an attack in Istanbul, Turkey. And who can forget the dumpster fire that was Cologne, Germany on New Year's Eve, when hundreds of sexual assaults and robberies were committed against women by men of mainly Arab and North African origin. It is these attacks that I want to talk about today, because they seem to have led to several EU members finally opening their eyes and saying, no more. We're not allowing any more of these savages into our country. And yes, I'm being incredibly politically incorrect here, but frankly, if this is the way they celebrate the new year by raping innocent women, they need to be sent right back to the third world hole from which they came, where they will be hopefully sodomized by a horde of rabid camels. These attacks are precipitating some interesting changes in policy and outlook on the part of the Europeans, who were publicly initially very supportive of helping these refugees and allowing them to enter their borders. For example, Czech Republic wants something done about the extraordinary and unprecedented rise in sexual assaults in Europe, and they want the perpetrators immediately repatriated. Slovakia refuses to accept refugees, period. And Slovakia's prime minister recently said that the Muslim communities are threatening the European way of life. Germany has made it easier to repatriate foreign criminals and strip them of refugee status if they commit particular offenses. I'm assuming rape is one of those. Essentially, Germany, which has been one of the most welcoming countries to these so-called refugees, has now tightened criminal law to make deportation easier. Germany's people seem to have gotten over the whole welcome to Deutschland, we'll take your tired, your poor, and your raping savages attitude with regard to refugees. British press reported recently that 62% of respondents in a YouGov survey now think there are way too many refugees being allowed into Germany. This is compared to just over half the respondents in November. And now there's mob justice as well. The British Telegraph reported a violent backlash against the migrant community in Germany after a gang of men reportedly assaulted a group of Pakistani and Syrian asylum seekers recently. Meanwhile, the Russians seem to be using the situation in Europe to their advantage. Russian press reports that Russia's Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Rogozin traveled to Belgrade recently and warned Serbia against EU integration, saying it could lead to Cologne too. Well, it certainly benefits Russia not to have its allies and neighbors in the region integrate with the EU, and they're taking advantage of the opportunity to scare their neighbors away. The interesting thing is that the leader of the Muslim community in Germany is now painting Muslims to be the victims of terror. Ayman Mazayek, I think that's how you say his name, of the Central Council of Muslims, said, quote, "We've received an incredible number of hate calls. You could call it telephone terror. This is a new thing. After incidents like this, we always, unfortunately, get a great many hate emails and letters. Oh, poor babies. But only a few calls. This has massively increased, although you have to really search to find our phone number. We're very troubled by this."
They're troubled? I'm fairly sure the victims of the hordes of Muslims who went on a raping and robbing spree during New Year's Eve in Cologne are even more troubled. Telephone terror? It sounds like they're deflecting blame here. Anything to avoid the issue of Muslim immigrants wreaking havoc in Europe.
It certainly sounds like it, doesn't it? Worse yet, this guy blames the right-wing mob, quote-unquote, for the seething anger that is now boiled over. It's true that far-right protesters in Germany blame the Cologne attacks on Germany's influx of refugees. And fact of the matter is, more than 1.1 million people claimed asylum in Germany in 2015. But that blame isn't exactly misplaced either. BBC reports that police in Cologne say 553 criminal complaints have been filed by women there, and 45% are for sexual assault. And according to authorities, the perpetrators were almost exclusively from an immigrant background, either Arab or North African. So this is not just empty right-wing hatred, even though Mazik seems to paint it as such. Facts are facts, and there's not much they can do to change them. So to paint themselves as victims of phone terrorism, while real victims have been sexually assaulted and robbed, is pretty heartless and repugnant.
What about our own refugee policy? Has anything changed there?
I haven't heard that anything changed. As a matter of fact, Obama has designated up to $70 million from a special fund set up by Congress for the purpose of addressing, quote, unexpected urgent refugee and migration needs. A senior administration official told CNN that the money is being used to follow through on the president's commitment last fall to bring in up to 85,000 refugees from around the world. Guess who's paying for them? And even at the State of the Union address, Obama invited a Syrian refugee to come sit next to his wife as a pointed message to those who are concerned about the issue, as did a Massachusetts representative. A 9-year-old boy who had both his arms blown off in a refugee camp attack and over whom the mainstream media was drooling. What does this tell you about the left's attitude toward refugees? Look, I doubt anyone is heartless enough to suggest that there aren't horror stories happening to decent people out there, but the horror stories aren't limited to Syrian refugees. I would submit that the hundreds of women who were sexually assaulted or robbed in Germany as 2016 began would discuss their own horror stories, should we choose to listen.
All right, Nikki. It was good to talk with you. I'll see you again next week.
You bet. Take care.
Nikki blogs at thelibertyzone.com.
Plug of the week.
Well, I've got a lot of ARs.
Really?
Yeah, I've got like, I don't know, 5, 6. Like, I've lost count. I can't remember if I have 5 or 6.
Did somebody steal one? Do you need to report that to the police, lost or stolen?
But they're not lost or stolen. I just don't know how many I've bought.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Most of them started off as lowers. Anyway, that's beside the point. The problem is, everywhere I go, I have to bring all my guns cased. And I only had, like, the one carbine case and, like, one single scoped rifle case. So it was very limiting as far as, like, trips to the local range. So I just bought a UTG, don't laugh, UTG, covert Homeland Security gun case.
Yeah, that seems kind of dorky.
Yeah, well, it does seem a little bit dorky, but it's $35, which is kind of what I was going for. I wanted something cheap that would, like, hold my carbine. Just one. I only needed to hold one. And it doesn't scream gun case.
No, it really doesn't. It just looks kind of like a bag.
Yeah, it's kind of plain, and I live in Nashville, so there's lots of, like, musical instruments that would kind of fit also in that bag. So the carbine case that I had before I bought this one is all, like, you know, olive drab, and, you know, Molly threw up all over it, and it's got all these, you know, patches and stuff. So it says, like, screams. Gun. It's like, yeah, this is a gun. Even for people who don't know what gun cases look like, this is a gun. But this new one, it just kind of looks like a little black case. Now, it's got, you know, the main pocket. It is a soft side case, by the way. The main pocket, of course, is where, you know, your rifle goes. And then it's got a secondary pocket that's got six spots for magazines, for rifle magazines. And then it's got another three, like, elastic places for, like, pistol magazines.
Oh.
Why you would have pistol magazines in your rifle case. I was looking for a cheap rifle case that would hold a carbine. This'll work. Check it out. Links in the show notes. I got the 34-inch one because that one was the one that was $35. They have them bigger or smaller, but there's, like, a significant price increase.
I guess I could take my rifle and I could put the suppressor on it and I could see how long that was, and then I could buy the appropriate size. But it goes everywhere from a 25-inch at $28.87 all the way up to 42 inches at $64.56. So pick your poison. We link to the 34-inch version, $34.68. And 34-inch will fit an AR.
Yeah.
With a collapsible stock.
Right.
Oh, look at that. It just fell into my wish list.
Oh.
Fun with headlines.
So I found this one right before the show started, and I couldn't stop laughing. So this is the week of President Obama's final State of the Union address, which we all thought was going to be all gun control all the time, because he had previously that week, well, the week before, issued a bunch of executive orders that basically said everybody has to follow the Gun Control Act of 1968.
Right. And the Brady Act.
And the Brady Act.
And then on Thursday, CNN ambushed him. Did you watch any of that?
I did not watch any of that because I thought it was going to be a love fest. And now I know, man, that it was a hate fest, and I really want to find it.
Oh, man. I will send you a link. It was brutal. In fact, I don't have to send you a link. Go down into the show notes and take a look at the video, Barack Obama Town Hall. It's in Weird's.
Oh, yes. Segment. So I guess we'll get to that.
That later in the show. Weird's going to fisk it. Oh, my goodness. It was brutal. So Thursday, that happened last week. And then, after all of that, boom, he just, like, all right, I've gotten beat up enough. I'm not even going to do anything with it at the State of the Union. Like, oh, seriously.
Wah, wah, wah.
But here it is in the headlines. It looks like some people are going to comply with what the president wants. What are they saying?
More gun stores doing background checks for online sales.
Ooh, all right. Finally, somebody is doing background checks on these internet sales.
Yeah, and so originally what I thought, like when I read that, I'm like, oh, okay, cool. So, like, that means that local FFLs are allowing me to put my gun up on Craigslist, sell it to you, meet you at their shop, and they'll run a NICS check for me. But wait, they can't do that. That's not legal.
Well,
it's not in Tennessee. You can't run a NICS check unless you are the dealer selling the gun.
Can't you sell it to them and they sell it to your neighbor?
Yes, you could do that. So
that's how they would do it here if that's what you wanted them to do. You could, right, sell it to the FFL and the FFL could sell it to your neighbor.
Right. So more gun stores doing background checks for online sales. Now we've said what we thought the story was about. Now let me just go ahead and read you the story. The internet sales tax loophole has been drastically reduced in Tennessee, but there are still loopholes in clothing, photo equipment, and guns. Guns ordered online must be shipped to a gun store. That store must then do the background checks and other paperwork for another store's gun sale. With gun sales on the rise, Guns & Leather in Greenbrier has never been busier. Some potential gun owners first handle the gun in a store before purchasing the weapon at an out-of-state website that doesn't charge sales tax. "We have to record the gun and record the process and do the background check," said Dennis Williams, owner of Guns & Leather. "It's kind of like helping our competitors with their business. It's called a gun transfer. For a $25 fee, gun stores do all the work. The thing you hate to see, the folks who come in and you work for an hour or two to help them pick out a gun, and then they turn around and leave," Williams said, "and then you transfer the gun into your own store." Guns aren't the only items that fall through the sales tax loophole. Several companies like B&H and L.L. Bean won't agree with Tennessee to charge sales tax. So I'm just going to stop here because this is a sales tax story. This is not a gun story. This is a sales tax story.
I'm confused. If a gun crosses state lines from a FFL to a person that is going to purchase that firearm, ultimately, it has to go through an FFL in that state, according to the Gun Control Act of 1968.
Correct.
So this story here says that they are following the Gun Control Act of 1968.
Yes.
Just like they did last week.
Right. And the week before, and the week before that, all the way back until 1968. Of course, we didn't really have
background checks
until 93, and we didn't have the internet really until like 95-ish. The web.
Exactly.
Tim Berners-Lee. Nobody got AOL until like 96. So anyway, yeah. So they're doing what they've been doing for 20 years. And
there's no sales tax on it because it's coming in from out of state.
Right. Except our sales tax is a sales and use tax, and you're required to report to the state anything that you bought out of state and brought back to the state and pay sales tax on it. So that's what this story is really about, is people are buying stuff out of state and then not paying the sales tax on it.
Good to know.
See, Tennessee doesn't have an income tax, so we have a really high sales tax.
This week, Barron tells us how to keep pop-ups, ads, and malware from sneaking up on us while we're browsing the internets in
Tech Tips.
Tech Tips. Tech Tips.
You are damaging my calm.
Tech Tips with the Barron.
Barron, how do I get rid of all those annoying internet ads?
Sean, it's actually a bit more deep than that. How do I protect myself from malicious advertisers? I've talked previously about CryptoLocker.
That's that malware that encrypts your hard drive and then demands a ransom to unlock it, right?
Yep, and 2016 is already showing to be a year where it just gets worse. The malware has been modified so it can run within JavaScript, allowing it to run within a web browser. Ideally, this isn't that bad, but the world is far from ideal, and code running within a browser session can escape via unpatched and undisclosed security exploits, and the host system thereby compromised.
That's one of the reasons why you say patch it regularly, isn't it?
Yep. They're known as zero-day exploits because the number of days between discovery and active use is zero or less. Because what makes this worse is now you can have it run on any operating system too. Just because you're running OS X or Linux doesn't make you invulnerable.
Why do I really not like the sounds of where this is headed?
Because it's really bad news. So a decent number of us run ad blockers, not just to avoid ads, but to avoid this type of malware. Forbes recently started detecting and blocking the most common one, Adblock Plus. They were demanding people turn off their ad blockers so they could read their articles.
They tried that crap with me today. I refused.
Good thing you did, because it wasn't just advertisements that they wanted to share with you.
You mean there was malware there too?
Yep, and forcing you to turn off your Adblock software to read an article would have infected your computer. This isn't the first time either. People have created images that are exploits that ad services have regularly served up. They look and display fine, but under the hood, they're rewiring things within the operating system. So with that, here's some tips ranging from things you should do in general to some other tips that you should do if possible, but might make life difficult.
Doesn't that violate one of your personal rules on security? Security must be transparent to the user.
Yes, it should be. Good security practices should never get in the way of user doing legitimate work. The problem is the cards are stacked a bit against us due to the most likely things to be used against the user. So, first up, run Adblock Plus. This is basic and you should do it with no question. When things complain about you running it, think long and hard before disabling it. I'm running it in Chrome, Safari, and Firefox. Additionally, it's running on all my mobile devices. Install it anywhere you hit the web. Install something like NoScript, which is available for Firefox, or ScriptBlock for Chrome, and there's another for Safari, but I don't remember what it is off the top of my head. This will allow you to selectively enable and disable JavaScript. This is the number one thing that's being used right now to spread malware. However, that's the problem child. There are some websites that will break and break so hard that you have to fully disable NoScript. If this gets in the way often enough, the user is just going to turn it off. NoScript by far has the best UI to try and help mitigate this problem, but still isn't perfect. Only enable the scripts for the domain which you're visiting. If it's pulling a script from an external domain, don't bother with it. It's probably tracking you in one form or another. Shouldn't be required. And the last tip is for the power users and the most paranoid amongst us. It's ideally the best choice, but it's the most complicated. Run a virtual machine with snapshots for all your web browsing. While it takes a bit more work, it's by far the best option because it will perfectly sandbox the rest of your system.
So in other words, I need to block ads not just to save bandwidth and decrease load times, but to stop malware too.
That's right, Sean. It's by far something you should do just to keep your computer clean and safe.
All right, Baron. It was good to talk with you. I'll see you again next week.
See you next week, Sean.
Baron still blogs at the-minuteman.org. And as an aside, I'm a professional, and I have gotten hit by malware from news sites twice. Like bad stuff.
Ugh.
It's nasty out there.
The J-Block. I read an article today that I just thought was really good by Grant Cunningham. The problem with defensive shooting is that it's dominated by enthusiasts. And that's not necessarily good for you. I thought this was a terrible headline, and I thought, I'm going to read this, and I'm going to tear this dude a new one, because this is the dumbest thing ever. And then I started reading it, and I'm like, oh, I see what he's saying here. Okay, yeah, that's actually pretty good. It's not a clickbait headline. It's just a poor headline. It doesn't tell you what he's trying to tell you. Grant Cunningham points out that people like you and I tend to be enthusiasts and not concealed carriers. We're enthusiasts first and concealed carriers second. We're gun guys, and that leads to problems. He compares it to the days when he was totally into cameras and he looked down on those autofocus cameras because the totally manual cameras were better. Of course, the guy coming in the door to the camera shop wanted a pure manual hobbyist camera. Why would he want one of those newfangled auto magic cameras that would make it easy to take good photos of their kids at parties? That just makes it harder to do all those neat tricks that you really totally need a manual camera to pull off that only geeky camera guys would even try to pull off. Well, gun guys can be the same way. When someone is asking you about guns, the most important thing you need to know is, why are they asking you this question? What do they want to know? And I'll bet you $10 they're not asking you this question so that they can bask in the glory of all of your esoteric knowledge. If the guy or gal wants to know how to carry a gun, tell them. But don't try to tell them that they have to change their entire lifestyle to carry it just like you carry because there's only one way to carry. This reflects something that PDB says occasionally. He reminds us that just because we're willing to dress like hobos with untucked shirts so we can dress around our guns, doesn't mean everybody else wants to do that. Just because we're gun guys and we'll rearrange our lives around carrying guns and go to training and get all into the minutia of carrying a gun, doesn't mean that the guy asking us about how to carry a gun wants to follow us down that particular rabbit hole. So stop being that guy.
So Sean, does that mean that you're totally okay with like pocket nines now? You've come around, right?
I actually don't like 9mm pocket guns for a very different reason. What really chaps my butt about the Micro 9s, it's not the Micro 9 itself. It's the attitude that breeds the Micro 9. I can't conceal a Glock 19. I can't possibly conceal that. It's too big. Everybody will see it. Oh, it's so easy to see. It's not really that easy to see at all. Most people can't see. Most people won't look. Weird talks about this. He says he's made a couple of guys with their guns. And you know how he tells that they're carrying guns? It's because they show up with their operator hat and their 5'11 pants and, you know, their tactical shirts.
Right.
And he's like, okay, if I was going to say who in here is carrying a gun, that dude right there is carrying a gun. Now let me look for it. Right? That's how he figures them out.
Right.
Like, that dude's carrying a gun. I know he's carrying a gun. I know he has to be because that dude dresses like a dude who's carrying a gun. Like, that right there, I mean, like, culturally, that's a dude who's carrying a gun. And he starts looking for it. He doesn't go, oh, well, look at that bulge right there. There's a gun. Oh, yeah. Yeah, there it is. No, that's not how it happens. And Weird's out looking for it. I don't even bother looking. What I don't like about microguns is people don't shoot very well to begin with. Most of us just don't shoot that well. And then you give him a little tiny gun, and then it gets worse. Now, I think it's pretty easy to conceal a Glock 19. That size of gun, not that hard. Glock 17, it gets a little tougher. But I can understand, don't want to try, no problem, don't do it. But I carry a Glock 19 size handgun under an untucked polo shirt. Wear cargo pants, untucked polo shirt. I don't look like a hobo. Now, I don't look like I'm ready to go business casual either, but still, it's not that big a deal. It's possible for me. But if it's not a possibility for you, hey, that's great. That's okay. But really sets me off, though, is the idea that, oh my goodness, someone's going to see it. It's not that you want to carry a little gun because the particular lifestyle you lead means that the particular clothes you have to wear for your job means you need something a little smaller. It's the idea that you think you need to hide. It's that well. It needs to be that concealed so that nobody sees it. No, that's not true. That is definitely not true. And the proof of that is Jennifer from In Jennifer's Head. Because she can wear girly clothes and carry the tactical toaster, the FNH or the FNP or FN something 45 tactical, which is basically Glock 34 sized.
It's the size of my laptop.
It's freaking gigantic. And brown.
Yeah.
It's enormous. And she carries that. She carries two magazines, which are what, 13 rounds? They're freaking gigantic.
I want to say that it's like a 17 round 45.
I don't think it's that big, no.
Maybe it's 15.
Whatever it is.
But it's gigantic.
Gigantic. And she carries a TDI knife. She's not carrying a Micro 9. And you've seen Jen.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking the Jolly Green Giant here.
No.
If you had to put her against Tam, you'd think that Tam would be a whole lot easier to conceal a gun of that size, right? You know, Tam's,
right.
What, 5'9", 10, 11?
Yeah, I think she's taller than me, and I'm 5'8".
Right. She's about my height.
Yeah.
Jen's 5'4"?
If that.
Wears high heels? 120 pounds?
Yeah.
Wears girly clothes?
Right.
She can carry the FNP 45 tactical? Yeah, okay. You can wear nice clothes and can conceal. Now, you don't have to if you don't want to. If you really want to carry your little gun, great. Great. Go ahead. Nobody's going to stop you. But don't be telling me, oh, I got to do that because I can't conceal anything bigger. That's not true. Nor do you have to dress like a hobo and change your entire life to do things the way I do either. That's also not true. So live your life how you're going to live it. That's great. I really think that this is a great article that reminds people like me who are like, just dress around your gun, fool, that maybe that's not the right answer. You know, maybe that's not the thing we need to be telling people, especially their first day in the gun community. Hey, guess what? You need to change everything about your life because you've decided that maybe it's a good idea to carry a firearm for self-protection. So everything that you've done before in your life, not important anymore. Stop doing all of that. Now you need to center your life on this new thing that you're going to do, carry a gun. Probably not good, useful advice.
Yeah.
Because what do you do?
You throw up a barrier to entry.
That's a good way to put it, yes.
Yeah.
If I tell you, hey, if you want to do this thing, you have to change everything else in your life, have I asked them to take responsibility for their life and become protective of themselves and others? Or if I asked them to join a cult?
And be a ninja.
You know what? If you're going to change everything about your life, may as well be a ninja or a pirate.
Right?
At least that's fun. You know, you get a funny costume. Be a pirate. They get a better costume.
Yeah, I guess they do.
Seriously, if you're going to be something, if you're going to totally change your life, yeah, be a pirate, be a ninja. At least you get a cool costume. You can actually do that in public and people are like, oh, that's cool. Because you can be a concealed carrier. Nobody's going to be able to tell the difference. If you're going to join a cult, join a real cult. Don't be this cult. This cult's actually kind of boring. So read this article. The article is called "The Problem with Defensive Shooting is That It's Dominated by Enthusiasts." That's not necessarily good for you. The link is in the show notes. And now, a word from our sponsor. You know what will happen. If you ever have to defend yourself, you're going to end up in handcuffs. Are you trained to win the fight after the fight? Sure, you can draw, aim, and put two in the ten ring, but have you learned your legal self-defense? Do you know the law? Go to lawofselfdefense.com/variety to sign up for your legal self-defense class. Each class is tailored to the laws in your state. Attorney Andrew Branca will teach you the law. Not just what the law says, but what the judge's legal opinions say. What the jury instructions say. Sure, you could risk spending the rest of your life in prison because you followed the advice of some gun store counter jockey, or you could spend the day with the man who literally wrote the book on the law of self-defense. Carry a gun so you're hard to kill. Know the law so you're hard to convict. Go to lawofselfdefense.com/variety to sign up for a legal self-defense class in your state, and make sure to use discount code VARIETY at checkout to receive 10% off.
This podcast runs on your donations. Go to gunblogvarietycast.com and click on the Donate or Subscribe button in the right sidebar. You can make a one-time donation of any amount or subscribe for as little as $2 a month. That doesn't sound like much, but we pay our server costs monthly. A little help from you is a big help to us.
Ever since the president's CNN town hall, Weird's been giddy like a little girl. If you didn't watch it, you missed out. The president got slapped around like he owed somebody money. Weird said he's got weeks worth of material out of it, so here's part one in This Week in Anti-Gun Nuttery. So hey, Weird, what do you got for me this week?
So this is probably the biggest audio clip for the gun rights side I've ever dealt with. Rather than just carving out the very choicest morsels for one segment and leave some great clips on the cutting room floor, I'm going to work on this event for several weeks, each week having a different theme. So for a quick intro, this was a CNN-run show. They called it a town hall, but in fact it was an invitational where big-name fighters on both sides of the Second Amendment issue were invited. Though I will note that I recognized more anti-gunners in the background than Second Amendment supporters. And several guests were allowed to ask the president one pre-screened question. It was a very interesting show, and I recommend everyone to clear out an hour of their time to watch the video, which is linked in the show notes. This week is going to focus on Obama's warm-up with Anderson Cooper before they got to the guests and their questions. I call this segment The Lies, and you'll soon see why.
There's a lot of people out there tonight watching who don't believe you. There's a lot of people in this room who frankly don't believe you. And it's not just that you don't really have personal experience having owned a gun, but it's that things you've said, support for Australia's tough anti-gun policies. They banned semi-automatic assault rifles. They banned even shotguns in Australia, right. Praised their policies over and over. Back in 2008, you talked about bitter Americans clinging to their guns. Even now, these executive actions have caused a lot of concern among a lot of people. What can you say to somebody tonight to convince them that you don't want to take away everybody's guns, that you're not coming for their guns?
Wow. This is Anderson's first question out of the gate. As an invitational with screened questions, you can easily see how a network known for its liberal slant could turn this into Obama love fest and a slaughterhouse for the pro-gun activists invited. This wasn't the case this evening.
Back in 2007, 2008, when I was campaigning, I'd leave Chicago, a city which is wonderful. I couldn't be prouder of my city, but where every week there's a story about a young person getting shot. Some are gang members and it's turf battles. Sometimes it's innocent victims.
55 people have been shot in Chicago in the last 7 days.
Sometimes it's happened just a few blocks from my house, and I live in a reasonably good neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. So that's one image, right? Talking to families who've gone through the pain of losing somebody because of violence in Chicago, gun violence. Michelle and I are then campaigning out in Iowa, and we're going to farms and we're going to counties. And at one point, Michelle turned to me and she said, you know, if I was living in a farmhouse where the sheriff's department's pretty far away and somebody can just turn off the highway and come up to the farm, I'd want to have a shotgun or a rifle to make sure that I was protected, my family was protected. And she was absolutely right. And so part of the reason I think that this ends up being such a difficult issue is because people occupy different realities. There are a whole bunch of law-abiding citizens who have grown up hunting with their dad or going to the shooting range, and
are responsible gun owners. And then there's the reality that there are neighborhoods around the country where it is easier for a 12 or 13 year old to purchase a gun and cheaper than it is for them to get a book.
First, my apologies to our listeners for such a long clip of our great orator, President. I did trim a quick quip about Obama admitting he's good for gun sales, but the rest is his answer in its entirety to that first question. Did you anywhere hear an answer to Anderson's question? I might be able to infer that Obama is claiming that he favors draconian gun control in urban areas, but might be willing to allow some cracker out in the sticks to have a rifle or a shotgun for personal defense. Still, I can only speculate what Barry's answer has to do with the price of tea in China. And then come the lies. Do you really think Michelle Obama said this? She's from Cook County. Do you really think she'd be the least concerned about crime when she was in flyover farm country compared to what she was used to back home? Especially since her husband had a security detail for quite a while. Also, he gives the urban versus rural comparison. You know what I hear? Urban. Low gun ownership. Very low legal gun ownership. High gun laws. High violent crime. Rural. Damn near ubiquitous gun ownership. And if any of them illegally owned, it's probably on a technicality that they're unaware of. And almost no crime. Why are we so focused on guns? Also amusing that Mr. Cooper had the gunshot victim number for Chicago on the tip of his tongue. He's also falling on the old saw of conflating lawful gun owners with criminals illegally owning guns, and using it as a leverage for more gun laws. This is why we say enforce the laws on the books. If gun crime is committed by drug dealers and pimps and gangbangers, then round the bastards up and lock them up so they can't hurt anybody. Don't go passing more laws that you also won't enforce. And easier to get a gun than a book? And cheaper? What is he smoking? Who buys this crap? I've found books in the damn garbage. I've downloaded dozens of free books from Amazon on my Kindle. And has Barry never set foot in a town library? How about the library at the public schools? Hell, it isn't even too damn hard to shoplift a book from the bookshop at your local mall. Try shoplifting a Glock from your local gun store or your local black market arms dealer.
First of all, it's important for everybody to understand what I've proposed and what I haven't proposed. What I've said consistently throughout my presidency is I respect the Second Amendment. I respect the right to bear arms. I respect people who want a gun for self-protection, for hunting, for sportsmanship. But all of us can agree that it makes sense to do everything we can to keep guns out of the hands of people who would try to do others harm or to do themselves harm. Because every year we're losing 30,000 people to gun violence. Two-thirds of those are actually suicides. Hundreds of kids under the age of 18 are being shot or shooting themselves, often by accident, many of them under the age of 5. And so if we can combine gun safety with sensible background checks and some other steps, we're not going to eliminate gun violence, but we will lessen it. And if we take that number from 30,000 down to, let's say, 28,000, that's 2,000 families who don't have to go through what the families at Newtown or San Bernardino or Charleston went through.
So Anderson points out the correct fact that criminals don't acquire their guns by any subterfuge, like lying to a private seller that they aren't a gangland soldier. Nope, they steal them, buy them from other criminals, or have family and friends engage in a straw buy. Again, Obama doesn't feel the need to actually answer the question, instead just decides to layer on the lies. He respects the Second Amendment? Nope. He's a Chicago politician. Ever hear him express regrets over supporting the Chicago firearms ban or the Illinois ban on carry that was struck down by the Supreme Court as violations of the Second Amendment? Nope, but he has expressed regrets over both those rulings. He does, maybe by mistake, tell the truth that two-thirds of the gun deaths are suicides, which is a totally different beast than violent crime in everybody's eyes, but then claims huge numbers of kids under 18 are being shot. Really, the block that he's talking about is 16 to 25, the age of a gang soldier. But then dives right off the truth bus, implying that under 18 suicides happen a lot with guns. They don't. That many shootings are accidental. Accidental shootings are almost nothing. And kids under 5? Sorry, but if you have a gun in your home and a child under school age, they will more likely meet their end by drowning in a bucket, pool, or tub, or toilet, falling down the stairs, or die in some sort of auto accident. You have to dive way down the CDC list before you get to guns for mortality in this demographic. It just isn't true. And if you want to make things better for families, we're at an amazingly low level of violent crime, despite being in a really nasty recession, with an all-time high of gun ownership and people exercising their right to carry. The only reason it isn't 28,000 is because we've had an increase in suicide. But Obama's wanted to expand the definition of mentally incompetent, which drives people away from getting proper medical help and drives them to suicide. Look, either seeking mental health works or it doesn't. Pick it. Yeah, you care, you filthy ghoul.
Let's go back to the city of Chicago that has strong gun control laws. And oftentimes the NRA will point to that as an example and say, see, these things don't work. Well, the problem is that about 30-40% of those guns are coming from Indiana across the border, where there are much laxer laws. And so folks will go to a gun show and purchase a whole bunch of firearms, put them in a van, drive up into Mike Flager's neighborhood on the south side of Chicago, where his parish is.
Ooh, that iron pipeline! We've really beaten this to death. First up, yes, Indiana is the number two state that turns up in ATF traces in Illinois, number one being Illinois itself. But it is only 16% of the guns traced. That 40% number is roughly all guns traced outside of Illinois. And of course, the average time to crime is 12.8 years. So either Barry is lying, or traffic between Indianapolis and Chicago is way worse than Boston rush hour. Okay, I'm gonna stop here. We'll continue with this epic event next week.
All right, Weird. It was good to talk with you. I'll see you again next week.
Just wait till you hear what I've got next week, Sean.
In addition to appearing here, Weird is a regular host on The Squirrel Report and blogs at weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com.
Stuff that grinds my gears. Adam, why don't you go first this week?
So I was on a business trip to the Dallas-Fort Worth area this week. Wow, Dallas is flat. I'm pretty sure that I could see the control tower from every building that I visited while I was in Dallas. And I wasn't exactly near the airport. So there was one point where we went to a Fry's, and it was in this shopping center called Mount Olympus. I was like, what are they talking about? It turns out it was like, I don't know, some former landfill or something. And so it was like the highest point in Dallas, and you could like see Nebraska from there or something. I don't know. And it wasn't very high, right? The thing that got me was their interstate system was like completely insane. Our hotel was near this exchange that actually has a name. It's called the High Five Exchange. It is 12 stories high. There's a picture in the show notes that I grabbed from Wikipedia. You can just look up the Wikipedia entry for High Five Interchange. And it's five interstates and service roads and whatnot. Well, it's five different levels, right? And the interchange itself has 60 miles of road.
Does look a bit like somebody threw a pot of spaghetti on the ground.
Yes. Now, this interchange, while crazy, is not really what I'm talking about. You see how they're all elevated?
Yeah.
Well, not all of them are elevated, but most of them are elevated.
Right.
So I-635 is elevated like five, six stories above the ground for miles, tens of miles, for no particularly good reason. It's not like there's a premium on land in Dallas. It's Texas. You can make the roads wider. You can make the roads go different places. It's totally okay. Also, like, trying to get on the interstates was weird because they're all elevated, right? So you had to like go under and then like loop around and like then go, you know, hold your tongue sideways and do all these like really weird things to actually get on the interstate. Now, I'm sure that if I lived there, I would get used to it pretty quickly. But it was really jarring to go from Nashville to there and see like, I don't know, LA style freeways all over the place.
You have to wonder if maybe they have a reason for it.
I'm sure that they do have a reason for it.
You have to hope that the reason wasn't because we can.
Right. I have to hope it was a reason outweighing the tremendous cost of building your interstates five stories off the ground. So how about you, Sean? What you got?
I read a story this morning about what happens when lying liars meet people who don't know what they're talking about, especially reporters who don't know what they're talking about. What's hilarious about this article is that it got busted within hours. It showed that there were 7 FFLs inside of the District of Columbia.
Wait.
This story came from CityLab, from The Atlantic. And I haven't noticed that The Atlantic does the greatest job in the world about things they don't understand, like guns. And CityLab is basically like, let's show you data, I guess. That's what they're doing here. And what happened was, is apparently Tanvi Misra, whoever in the heck that is, Tanvi Misra got taken in hook, line, and sinker. Tanvi Misra is a staff writer for CityLab covering demographics, inequality, and urban culture. She previously contributed to NPR's Code Switch blog and BBC's online news magazine. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives reports that 64,747 licensed gun dealers, defined here as gun shops, pawnbrokers, or individual sellers, existed in the U.S. as of December 2015. But raw numbers alone might not mean much to you. So a new mapping project by DataViz company 1.21 Interactive. 1.21, does that sound like 1.21 gigawatts from...
It does.
That's all I can think of.
Yeah.
Tries to contextualize this number by comparing it to something all Americans know exists in abundance, Starbucks. Looking at the federal firearms license data, the first question I asked myself, is that a lot? It sounds like a lot. Brian Belts, who helped put the project together, tells CityLab, that's why we chose to compare it to something that everyone knows and has a reputation of being on every corner. So Brian Belts, lying liar, Brian Belts, lying, not even a very good liar, Brian right? Belts, decides he's going to take every single Type 01 FFL and slap it on the map. Now, people who actually know something about FFLs, and I understand a lot of gun owners have no idea what an FFL, Type 1 FFL actually is, what that means, a Type 1 FFL.
But we're enthusiasts.
Right, you know, as we learned in one of our previous section, we are, you know, enthusiasts here. A Type 01 FFL is a shop that sells guns. It is also gunsmiths. There are a few other reasons one might have a Type 01 FFL. That doesn't exactly mean that you sell firearms at retail.
So a friend of mine has an 01 FFL, and all he does is Kira-coat things.
So like spray paint them?
Yes, all he does is spray paint guns.
Right.
But if you're going to keep a gun overnight, you have to have an 01 FFL.
So he's effectively a gunsmith.
Yes.
Right. So they took and mapped every one of the 01 FFLs, 64,747 of them, and threw them on the map. Well, I took a look at the 01 FFLs for Washington, D.C. to get all of the names. And guess what? There's 7 of them.
Seven.
There's 7 01 FFLs.
But isn't there only like the one guy that you can buy a gun from and he doesn't even have like a real shop?
Exactly. That was the funniest part about the whole thing was they tried to claim that there were all of these FFLs in the Washington, D.C. area. Literally. In the article, they show a map of the D.C. area. If you zoom in, if you click on the map and write Washington, D.C. firearms versus Frappuccinos, Washington, D.C. find Washington gun dealers, 318, Washington Starbucks, 322. And it shows this loop that's like 25 or 30 or 50, I don't know how many miles in diameter. It goes all the way to Baltimore in one direction and halfway to the Marine Corps base at Quantico the other direction. As if anybody who lives in Washington, D.C. could go to Baltimore and buy a handgun at the gun store in the outskirts of Baltimore, crossing state lines in the process, the same way he could buy a Frappuccino at any cross-border Starbucks. But if you take a look at actual D.C., there are 7 FFLs, which hopefully, the ATF will provide that data for you.
Which is how they got the data.
Exactly. There are 7 FFLs. 2 of them are held by the ATF themselves.
What? Okay.
The ATF holds two. I don't know why the ATF has to hold two FFL Type 01 FFLs. Maybe one of them's a gunsmith and one of them's a sales. I don't
know. Wait. If the ATF has FFLs, doesn't that mean they have to inspect themselves? And wouldn't they shut themselves down for losing all those guns in Fast and Furious?
We can only hope. Now, that person you were talking about, Charles Sykes, is the only FFL who will transfer, but he will not sell firearms within the city of D.C. to citizens. So you have to go to an outside FFL in Virginia, buy the gun, have them transfer it to Charles Sykes, and he will transfer it to you for a fee of some ridiculous amount of money, like $200.
Yeah, I was going to say it's in the hundreds of dollars.
Two of them, believe it or not, are held by theaters so that they can receive firearms.
In air quotes, yes.
For stage plays. Shakespeare Theater, and I forget what the other theater was. And one is held by K&S Supply, which will only sell to government and law enforcement. So that's six. And guess who holds the last FFL in the city of District of Columbia?
My favorite FFL in the entire country.
Josh Sugarman. Notorious anti-gunner Josh Sugarman holds the last FFL in D.C. He says that he owns it because, well, people sometimes give him guns and he didn't want to be breaking the law by receiving a gun. So I also mapped all of the FFLs in the zip code that I live in, and they all, 4 out of the 11 were actual stores. One was Dick's Sporting Goods. One was Walmart. One of them was the Cabela's that just opened. One was a gun store that I sort of knew about. And all of the rest of them were gunsmiths in people's houses.
Mm-hmm.
So this 64,000 or however many that they have, yeah, bunch of gunsmiths in people's houses.
And they compared Starbucks, a single company that sells coffee, to all 01 FFLs, which would include, as you said, Walmart and Dick's and Academy.
And your friend who Cerakotes guns.
Yes, yes. So they're trying to say, oh, look, well, you know, you can. It's easier to find some place to buy a gun than it is to get coffee. Well, no, let's overlay everywhere that you can get coffee.
Yeah.
Gas stations, the same Walmarts, Kroger.
And I'm pretty sure if I asked really nicely, the guys down at Cabela's will get me a cup of coffee.
That's probably true, yes.
With the gun they sell me. What grinds my gears is when people who write these stories are so stupid that they can't even tell when they're being lied to. Well, that's our show for the week.
Thanks again to Rob Allen for our music.
And Firearms Policy Coalition for their support.
And thank you for listening to Gunblog Variety Cast.
Constructive criticism can be sent to Sean at SeanSorrentino.com.
And hate mail to WizardPC at GunsCarsTech.com.
Like and share us on Facebook.
If you have Facebook.
And if you receive this podcast through iTunes, make sure to leave us a glowing 5-star review.
Show notes can be found at GunblogVarietyCast.com/episode 74.
This is a URS production.